more time. Hopefully it's not just time for delay. So I'm not satisfied with where we are, and I hope we can get something done quickly. John, next question.
Yep. To remind everyone, it's star 3 to ask a question. Our next one is Barbara in Pine Bush. Barbara, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I just thought that these storms were a good moment to ask a question about where you see the infrastructure bill going. A lot of congressmen are talking about, well, we have such a big deficit that we can't, you know, we have to cut back on this kind of spending. We all know that that deficit was created in large part through the tax bill, so that's not a very good argument. So I'd like to know what your position is on what the most urgent needs are for a federal role in infrastructure.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Two things. One, we had a hearing today and yesterday in the Transportation Committee. We had Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, and we had a number of transportation advocates in the Transportation Committee today. It really comes down to funding and how we make sure that the Highway Trust Fund is properly funded, and there are a number of proposals out there to do that. The President's proposal is incomplete, in my view, in the sense that he does call for creating an opportunity for private investors to come in and make investments in airports, for instance, and they would get a long-term lease to run the airport. The government would get a tranche of money that would, in some cases, be the hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars over a long-term period of time. So it's very important that we look at all these, explore all these options. And so I'm committed to trying to get something done. I've proposed a couple of things, including a bill that would expand and make less expensive some of these projects, federally funded projects in New York State. In fact, I just got a great article, which we posted online today, about my legislation. So there are a lot of Democrats and Republicans that want to get something done, and I'm one of those people that believes that infrastructure, roads, sewers, bridges, transportation, mass transit, and broadband are critically important for our community. One thing I'd just say, Barbara, the tax bill, yes, it does, it counts scores at about $1.1 trillion over a 10-year period. That is not the major driver of our debt and deficit. So I do think that we have to look at the fact that our debt and deficit is a bipartisan problem, and we do have to address it and fix it. But the tax bill was a part of it, but not certainly the main driver of this debt that we're facing as a nation. John, who's the next caller?
Our next caller is Amy from Amenia. Amy, are you there?
I am, yes.
Hi, Amy. How much snow are you getting in Amenia right now?
It's snowing a lot, and I have a huge tree down from last week's storm that I came home from being away from. I think it's probably 150 years old, so missed the house by that much.
Yeah.
It's pretty beautiful here, as long as but I have no power since last week, and no heat, so we're waiting patiently.
Yeah, I hope to get it soon.
Yeah, me too. It is beautiful, though, and we're keeping warm and cozy here. And
okay.
And luckily, the Amenia Town Hall is open with the Red Cross there for anyone who needs water and shelter and anything. So that's
good.
Great.
Good. All right, so what's your question?
So I really wanted to ask you what your thoughts are in, and I hope they're in, doing something to change the current rules and regulations on purchasing guns, and most importantly, these weapons that are not what my neighbors are shooting deer with. What do you have? There's got to be something that you feel has got to change to help us feel safer in a society and civilization where it's so busy. I take mass transit during the week. My neighbors are very concerned about the schools, yet, you know, they're also very concerned about owning their guns. So what are your thoughts on fixing or helping to fix this terrible problem?
So it's multifaceted. It's improving and closing loopholes that exist in the background check system. Amazingly, this young man passed a background check because he'd never been adjudicated, and he was never reported. He was expelled from school for violent acts. I'm told he was expelled from school for bringing a gun to school. And if that is indeed the case, that's really unbelievable. That should have been reported to law enforcement. But thirdly, the mental health issues have to be dealt with. Obviously, this was a very troubled young man. And obviously, the vast majority of people that have anxiety or depression.
Go ahead. Can I interrupt?
Sure.
You know, I understand that people have mental health issues, and it's very, very difficult. People themselves don't know if they have mental health issues. That's a very fine line. It's very difficult to determine who's got a mental health issue and who doesn't. Or, for that matter, who's going to snap or use a weapon inappropriately, even though they may never have done so in the past. So I think we really have to deal with, and I'm hoping that you don't skirt this issue of these terrible weapons that should not be, in my opinion, available to just anybody, whether they're 18 or 21. So can you maybe just address that more directly?
Sure. Well, the semi-automatic firearm that he had is a commonly owned weapon. There are about 5 million of those weapons in the United States. And obviously there are many tens of thousands of those within New York State. So to me, and if you look at the New York Safe Act, for instance, which so-called banned these type weapons, if you type in, go online, go to Google and type in Safe Act compliant semi-automatic, you'll find that there are weapons that are compliant with the Safe Act that are semi-automatic that have all of the exact characteristics of the weapon, the AR-15. So the bans have been enacted before, and it has not been especially effective because there are similar weapons that have not the cosmetic characteristics of that were included in those bans, but have the exact same firing capacity of the AR-15. So to me, I want to do things that we can get people on both sides of the Second Amendment issue together on making sure that certain people have no access to these firearms. This individual, the shooter in Florida, should have not had access to any firearm, whether it was a handgun or a BB gun, much less an AR-15. So there are many thousands, in fact millions, of semi-automatic handguns that are commonly owned in the country. This can cause significant damage as well. And in fact, there have been, I think it was the Virginia Tech shooter, for instance, that used semi-automatic handguns in his onslaught. So to me, the question is not so much the firearm, although I recognize this is a legitimate issue for debate and discussion. The issue is more how do we make sure that people like these individuals are blocked from purchasing any type of weapon. The shooter in South Carolina in the church, the black church down in South Carolina, that shooter was actually caught by the background check system, should never have been able to buy it, but there was a mistake between the law enforcement agencies. In this individual in Florida, the FBI had not one but two exact explicit warnings from citizens about this individual, and yet that was never passed through to the local field office. So, Amy, the point I'm trying to make is that we can talk all we want about bans, and I know that is superficially that is popular, and I understand why that is popular. But I don't think experience shows us that is not necessarily effective at keeping these weapons from people that, for one reason or another, have whether they're influenced by social media, whether they are have a mental problem that has not been addressed. Or whether like this school shooter in Florida who actually had a situation where he should have was expelled from school and the school authorities didn't report it to law enforcement. He should have been prosecuted for what he did in that school well before he took this tragic incident upon himself and killed these defenseless people. So the other thing that I think we have to do, and there's legislation that we're working on now, would be to expand the school security, hardening schools, and also taking a very close look at how we can make sure that relatives and people who know an individual who has an issue and they fear that he will, that person will take that issue and manifest it in an act of violence like this, that we can raise a red flag and bring it to the attention of authorities and bar that person, protecting due process, but bar that person. Indiana has a law just like this. It's had it on the books for about 10 or 12 years, and it's worked very, very well. New York has something like this now. So Florida had none of this, and I do think that it requires all of us who are in good faith wanting to solve this issue to address it and come to the table and actually compromise maybe some strongly held beliefs in order to get something that's going to make it better for our nation and our citizens, and certainly protecting vulnerable institutions like schools and other so-called soft targets is really important. Amy, I thank you for the call. It is really an important issue. It's one that a lot of us are working on to try to address here, and I hope we can get it done.
Perfect. I want to remind everyone that if you'd like to ask a question, please press *3 to be entered into the queue to ask. Our next question is Judy in Port Ewan. Judy, are you there?
I am here. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, in a way, a more general one about Congress than specifically, but I would like your views on Congress and the way it's working. I mean, the Republicans do have all the power, and yet I don't see significant things getting done unless, you know, taxes got done. 1, 2, 3, whip it through. Health care, trying to get rid of Obamacare, that was easy for them to, 1, 2, 3, let's get it done. But then when it comes to things like mass shootings or transportation or DACA, you know, immigration, they just don't get it done. And I'm very frustrated. And I'm feeling, as a citizen, Congress that Congress people aren't caring about the country. They are caring about their careers and their financial supporters and pleasing those people without really dealing with American issues. And I would like you, as somebody who's there, because obviously I get this opinion from observing, but somebody that's there, do you have a way to get more balance in what we get done and what we don't get done?
Sure. Well, number one, your frustration is one that I share. Washington doesn't work very well, and I'm down here now for 14 or 15 months, and it is definitely not a model of efficiency, let's put it that way. Number two, I would say that some things have gotten done. I actually didn't support the tax bill based on the SALT, the almost a complete elimination of the SALT deduction. However, they did enact that, the Congress did enact that, and there are many provisions in that bill that are going to be good for our economy and good for economic growth, and I think we're really seeing that. Number three, part of the reason is that the rules in the Senate require 60 votes to do anything, and it's very difficult to, in a partisan kind of environment, to get 60 votes in the Senate. That's one reason why I joined a thing called the Problem Solvers Caucus, which are 24 Democrats, 24 Republicans. And we meet frequently, and we talk about issues that we do agree on, and we're working to try to forge consensus on issues. So there are many people here in Congress on both sides of the aisle that are very public-spirited and want to get things done. The fourth thing I'd say, Judy, is that the founders actually made this system to be really cumbersome and difficult. They didn't create a parliamentary system like they had in England. That's what they came from, where as soon as you had a majority, you could pass anything through the parliament. They created a system with of separate branches and co-equal branches between the executive and the legislative, and then you have the equal judiciary off to the side. But in the Congress, you have two separately elected House and Senate. Each of us has its own prerogatives and powers, and then we pass legislation that goes to the president, who can sign or veto. So the founders intentionally made a system that was cumbersome and difficult. Now, that doesn't mean I'm satisfied with it, but that's the system that we have under our framework. Now, we are working on a number of things. We passed a bipartisan two-year budget extension after lots of fits and starts, and that is going to go a long way towards rebuilding our military, but also providing necessary funding for domestic priorities. The other thing is I'm working on things like the infrastructure bill we talked about, but also the farm bill, which is very important for our district. I'm on the Agriculture Committee. I expect we'll have a farm bill that'll be bipartisan and that will pass later this year. And that's a critical thing. And lastly, I'm proud that I'm the sponsor of a bill called the STOP Act. I have over 250 Democrats and Republicans on the bill in the House. There are over 30 in the Senate. And this bill would stem the flow of illegal fentanyl that's poisoning our people in our communities and killing them. Over 20,000 last year killed from illegal fentanyl coming in from China through the U.S. mail. So I'm a sponsor of that bill, which has over 250 co-sponsors here in the House, Democrat and Republican. So it doesn't make the media as much, and the media candidly focuses on the conflict and the negative, and that's just the nature of the beast. But a lot of things get done that you don't hear about necessarily. I encourage anyone that wants to follow what I do on a weekly basis, both in the district and here, to go to my website, faso.house.gov, and you can receive a weekly email from us telling us what we do, and you can make your own opinion about how well I'm fulfilling my duties. But I share your frustrations, Judy. I have it. We want to get things done more quickly. The process is often difficult to do that, but I'm going to keep trying, and I hope you will too. Don't get too discouraged, and stay involved and interested in what is happening in our country. Thank you for that. And star three for anyone who wants to get in queue. John Billings, who do we have next?
Our next question is Maria from Accord. Maria?
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm calling about healthcare, and it's interesting that you should mention fentanyl because I think that there are I know that President Trump was talking about getting illegal drug dealers off the streets, but really the whole opioid problem was caused by big pharmaceutical companies. These are corporations that need to be reined in. And I see that a lot of law and order efforts are going to ordinary citizens on the street when really the big actors are the big corporations. Now, as far as healthcare goes, my main question is other countries that are at our level of industrialization and sophistication, most of them have universal health care programs. People have health care as a right. They don't need to worry about it. And I know that you can give all kinds of long explanations about why we can't have that. I have heard you go on and on. That's not what I want to hear today. What I would like to hear is, yes, we can do it. And study after study say that a single-payer system is what's going to save us all a whole lot of money because we are just bleeding out to the insurance companies and to the pharmaceutical companies, and we don't have to do that anymore. Why can't this get off go? You know, the single-payer system was taken off the table by the insurance companies as soon as Obama started to try to create a healthcare system. And to me, I think that that is just a huge failure of our system.
Well, thank you for that. You and I do not share the same opinion about the virtues of a single-payer system. Even in countries which have these, that very frequently you will see annual debates and arguments in those countries over how much money is being spent in the system, people having waiting lists and long times in order to see specialists. So this, these systems are not a panacea. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that our system is perfect either. Far from it. It has a lot of things that are wrong with it. I don't think, though, especially given, I think, the cost of a single-payer system, which would be many, many hundreds of billions of dollars that, frankly, we don't have. And you would basically take people who are 175 million Americans who are in an employer-provided health care system, and you would now say that those people should go into a government-run system. Well, government-run systems have their virtues, and they have their faults. And I can tell you, I often deal with, I just met with a number of folks that came in this week with specific disease groups and isolated cases of diseases that only afflict a small number of people, relatively speaking, but talking about the difficulties they have in dealing with the Medicare or Medicaid bureaucracy. So there is no panacea in terms of how we create a system. The countries that have these single-payer systems have a lot of the same arguments that we're talking about here. And I do question whether or not it would be something that would be in the national interest in a country as big and diverse as ours, trying to put everyone into one government-run system. I recognize and respect your point of view. I have to say I do not agree with it. But I'm going to still keep trying to ensure that we can lower costs and deductibles for people by creating a reinsurance system that will take care of the people that have very high cost health care expenses. A reinsurance model has worked well in other states, and it would lower premiums and deductibles for people broadly throughout our country. Remember, when PolitiFact did their lie of the year in 2012 or 13, it was about the Affordable Care Act and this notion that if you liked your doctor, you could keep your doctor, and your premiums would go down an average of $2,500 a year. Turned out neither of those things were true. In fact, they're far off from being true. So I realize that there is going to be a difference of opinion here. I'm trying to find ways that we can address the need for health access to health care, but also deal with the affordability without tossing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. But I thank you for your call, and I respect your point of view, even though I do not necessarily agree with all of it. So, John, who is the next caller? Star 3 is the way to get on the queue.
Our next caller is Edward from Oneonta. Edward, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, good afternoon, Edward.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, it's really snowing up here in Oneonta.
How much have you got?
Well, we're counting about 12 and still going.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
The one thing I want to ask is, because we have an abandoned factory over here, are you going to do anything about job creation, maybe getting jobs for all of us here? I mean, most of us here are broke. You know, we can't even pay our own taxes.
Well, a couple of things. Some of the things that I've offered and pursued, I had a measure in the health care bill which did not pass. Last year, which would have finally ended New York's 51-year system of imposing part of the state's Medicaid costs on the local property taxpayers. In our district, $220 million a year comes out of property taxpayers to pay for what in most other states the state pays for through its income tax. And this is an outrageous situation. Our counties, the 57 counties outside of New York City, pay more in local Medicaid costs than all the local property taxpayers and the local taxpayers in the other 49 states combined. Think about that. It's one of the reasons why people leave New York, and the two things that people say the most to me in our district, you know, throughout the 11 counties, no matter where you go, is that local taxes are driving them out of their homes to other states, and their kids can't find enough jobs. So I am hopeful that some of the provisions that were in the tax bill, particularly as it relates to investment, small business pass-throughs, getting a 20% write-off on the first $200,000 or $300,000 that they earn as a deduction. This will greatly enhance the ability of the small business economy, which is largely what we have in our district in upstate New York, to thrive and prosper. And at the same time, I'm glad to see the reductions in corporate rates, which you're seeing companies bringing money back from overseas. Look at what Apple did. $252 billion brought back from overseas that they had stashed abroad. They pay $38 billion in taxes on that money, and they're creating 20,000 jobs in America over the next 5 years. So through proper incentives, I think that we can grow jobs, and but we've got to lower the cost of government and the cost of property taxes in our state, and that's one of the reasons why I'm also pursuing what I call the Infrastructure Expansion Act, which would say any federally funded infrastructure projects for roads or bridges, water, sewer, housing, et cetera, that the standard of liability in New York State for those projects would be the same as the standard in the 49 other states combined. This one feature in New York law, which we would preempt using federal authority, this one feature raises the cost of construction in New York State by an average of 7%. So every time you replace a roof on your house or you build a building or you're a government and you build a new building, et cetera, a new water treatment plant, the cost is arbitrarily raised because of our old-fashioned, antiquated New York laws that don't exist in any other state. Our workers are no safer in New York State than they are in other states, and yet we continually inflict these extra costs on our economy, on our taxpayers, on our businesses, particularly our small businesses, with nothing to show for it. So these are the things that I'm trying to highlight and to act upon to create a better job and economic climate in our state. This is really important. I'm glad you asked the question, and don't hurt yourself trying to shovel all that snow. So who's our next caller, John?
We have Jeff from Pleasant Valley. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I'm pro Second Amendment. I appreciate you also sharing my views. But I would also like to say that with 7/8 of the media, especially television and social media, being on the liberal side, they're instilling a lot of fear in these people that think that guns are, you know, the worst thing that could ever happen to society. They don't understand that a lot of these people that own guns, if they went to gun clubs and to gun stores, they would understand that these people are the most responsible, level-headed people that there are. It's just the criminals that are getting a hold of these guns that are giving us a bad name, and you have people on the liberal side like Bloomberg that are spending billions of dollars to go against guns and other things that they don't like that are instilling fear in these people. But my main thing I want to say is I think a lot of the problem may be with the HIPAA, with the right to keep your medical records private, and I don't know how the NICS database is supposed to get a hold of people that are mentally ill when we have HIPAA laws that protect them from that.
Okay.
And another thing is, too, a lot of these parents, you know, especially on the liberal side, that are going full bore against guns, that don't go to gun clubs or gun stores to talk to these people about how they feel. They just hate guns and they want to do away with them. They don't understand that drunk drivers, okay, cause more deaths than guns do every year, and also young people that are texting on phones are causing more deaths than these AR-15s are causing. But they would, if you ever tried to say that you wanted to ban students from having phones until they're 21, they would go crazy. So I don't understand where they're thinking.
Okay, let me cut you off there, Jeff, because I think we should. I get the gist of your question. I think that you raise an issue about HIPAA. This is an important issue, and I was speaking to one of my colleagues this morning who is a medical doctor, and who's from a state that has enacted laws that allow a relative to be able to get access to the certain aspects of a person's, their child's medical record, if that child is more than 18 years of age. And because who's better than a parent or a close relative to know whether someone could be a risk to themselves or someone else? You know, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in our country, especially among some of these younger men in our society. And I think that we need to have much better efforts to be able to deal with folks that may be suffering from acute depression or anxiety or other mental health issues, respecting the rights of people, but also making sure that public safety is first. Indiana has a law like this. It's been on the books for more than a decade, and I believe that it's worked relatively well. I think we've got to focus on how do we make sure that these mistakes, which clearly happened in this instance, don't happen and happen in other instances. That's why we do need to fix the deficiencies in this background check system. A number of states don't fully report into the background check system. And part of the bill we have under discussion that we passed in the House, is hopefully will pass the Senate as a standalone bill, deals with some of the deficiencies in state reporting. But here was the instance of this fellow in who was a dishonorably discharged Air Force veteran. The Air Force never reported his dishonorable discharge and his criminal violations with firearms to the background check system. And this is the individual who killed more than 20 people in a church in Texas a few months back. So we've got to address this, thinking that we're going to be able to confiscate millions of weapons, tens of millions of weapons, and indeed there are tens of millions of weapons that fall into the semi-automatic category, is, I think, not reality. And I think we've got to address things that really do try to prevent people from getting firearms who should never have them. And that's really what I think we should be focused on.
Okay, our next call is going to be Anthony from LaGrangeville. Anthony, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi. So my question, by the way, great call. I could delve into all of these topics, but I'm going to stick with what I was calling about.
Okay.
In the VA just got a boost to their budget of a couple of billion dollars, and it was already a pretty good-sized budget. In the meantime, you know, Hudson River Housing had that grant to serve homeless veterans in Dutchess County, and they lost it. It was a $516,000 grant. And my question is, with this new budget, are there some other funds that can be available to help Dutchess County residents? I mean, the program is still going, but as you know, without any real funds except for $100,000 that the county gave and money that we're basically getting from other organizations as we need it. But it's been pretty tough.
Yes, thank you for that. And I did intervene on behalf of that agency. The Veterans Administration came back with 2 points. One, they said they wanted to consolidate the Dutchess County area with an area that is also includes Westchester and an agency that provides these services to homeless vets in the lower Hudson Valley. They wanted to expand into Dutchess. The second thing they said is that, and this is what I really found to be objectionable, they said, well, the veteran homeless issue is not as bad and severe in Dutchess County, and they had a much lower rate of homelessness in Dutchess County. And I said, well, this is because this agency has been effective, and yet they are in essence being penalized for their success. I'm willing to take another run at the VA over this issue, but I'm not right now optimistic of success. But I do think it's an important issue, and I thank you, Anthony, for raising it. We will continue to try to deal with it, and we've also tried to effectuate a number of other reforms, particularly in terms of how the Veterans Administration deals with disability determinations. Excuse me. They had a over 400,000, close to 500,000 backlog of many years in disability determinations. In fact, our office interceded for one veteran who had a pending disability claim for over 18 years. And fortunately, we were able to get him a relatively large lump sum payment for his disability over that period, and also a monthly stipend going forward. But you shouldn't have to go to your congressman to deal with something that should be administratively handled by the VA. So we're trying to speed up that process. We enacted a law, bipartisan, signed by the president last year, and I'm hopeful that that will be of assistance to veterans. And I thank you for your call about homeless veterans in particular.
Our next caller is going to be John from Cobleskill. John, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, John.
Thank you for inviting me to this conversation.
Thank you.
As a dairy farmer, I have a lot of concerns. And I'm going to list three of them, and I'd like your response.
Yes.
Under the this tax reform bill just passed, there was Section 199 was eliminated, and 199A was introduced.
Yeah.
199A would give me a 20% deduction from my cooperative for my milk checks. This was specifically designed to go to cooperatives, payments received from cooperatives. There are a lot of farmers were concerned that they were not allowed the same deduction because they do not ship through a cooperative.
Yeah, they would ship through a private, privately owned grain terminal.
Right, or a dairy cooperative.
Yeah.
Now they're looking at they're examining that to try to tweak it.
Yeah.
And my concern is there has been some discussion to eliminate 199A altogether, and I hope you will lead the charge to improve it, but do not eliminate it, please.
Yeah, so I spoke to Chairman Brady of the Ways and Means Committee this morning. I was in a meeting with him, and he addressed it. He said they are trying to fix this because the intent was not to exclude the privately owned feed grain storage places where someone might sell their grain to. So this has created an imbalance where the private grain operators are basically disadvantaged to those that are owned and run by co-ops, by cooperatives. So this is a highly technical area of the law, but I appreciate you raising it, and we are trying to fix it. Again, if you have a particular issue there, please be in touch with our office as we go along, because I'm hopeful we can deal with it. What are the other two questions that you had?
Oh, I'm sorry, Congressman. He actually dropped off. Our next caller, though, has hopped on. We have Miriam from New Paltz.
Hi, Miriam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi.
Sure.
I'm from New Paltz, and I used to live on a farm that flooded three times with three so-called 50-year floods within a seven-year period. So I'm asking you about something that's kind of personal for me, actually. Which is climate change and the extremes of weird weather that we've been getting up here. They were certainly marked by the hurricanes down in the Caribbean and the southeast U.S. And Puerto Rico, and obviously the melting sea ice in the Arctic. I mean, there are a million red flags on this. What are you proposing to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels so that we can trim our sails and try to keep within the guidelines of the Paris Accords on climate?
Well, renewable energy is something that I've supported. There were provisions in the tax bill that, even though I didn't ultimately vote for the tax bill, were put in there that would extend tax incentives for renewable energy, and that was something that I had advocated for with the Ways and Means Committee. So I think that's important. We are gradually shifting to an economy which has increasing use of alternative and renewable energies, and I think that's important. On the ag side, I'm pursuing land conservation and soil and conservation techniques, which will lower CO2 emissions from agriculture and make, hopefully, our farms more productive and more economic, lessening thereby also the use of fertilizers, chemical fertilizers, which often create other issues in the environment. I'm part of the Climate Change Caucus in the House, which is an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, and we've proposed a number of things that would address this. For instance, last year, there was during our appropriations voting in the House on the Defense Appropriation Bill, there was a measure that would have ordered the Defense Department to no longer consider the impact of climate change on how it places defense facilities and the strategic issues that are associated with climate change and what that means for our national defense. I was among those that voted against that amendment, which would have taken away the ability of the Defense Department to do that. And I know that the Defense Department very much wants to make sure that our nation's defenses are well prepared to deal with the effects of climate change. I do think that there's a transition away from fossil fuels, but certainly the natural gas, which is much less CO2 emitting than, say, coal, has increasingly become a fuel of choice. And New York State has reduced its CO2 emissions by about 20% as we've replaced coal with natural gas and electric generation, and also taken a lot of the dirty heating oil out of the New York City apartment buildings. But it's a gradual thing, and I know that some folks don't want any fossil fuels whatsoever and want it to stop much quicker than I think probably is practicable. But I do think the market is moving in this direction. The big issue for us in terms of reducing CO2 is coming from not the electric generation sector, but the transportation sector. And that's where we need to pursue alternative fuel vehicles, electric battery-powered vehicles. And you're seeing, we estimate that within, I think it's 2 decades, we will have 30% of our auto fleet will be battery-powered or alternative fueled vehicles. So I think this is happening. The market is driving it. And the more we can use market-based incentives to do this, the better. I'm less trustful of government-dictated requirements. I think they're less efficient in the long run, and they wind up costing us more. And government sometimes makes big mistakes when it tries to order a particular type of fuel use or power generation. So I do think that the change is gradual, but I do share your concern and urgency about the issue of climate change, and I think it is real, it is man-made. The question of whether you, right at the outset, you mentioned the issue of the weather we're getting. A lot of people who are very astute in this area will say these are due to climatic forces, meteorological forces, not necessarily due to climate change generally. But that being said, regardless of the cause, we need to harden our infrastructure, and that's something that we need to do in any infrastructure bill to deal with highway and bridge and transit projects. You may notice that bridge project on 209 as you're heading towards Ellenville, notice how much higher the state is building that bridge. That's partially federally funded as well. It's an 80-20 federally funded project on that state route. And you see how the state is incorporating a much harder infrastructure by making safer bridge abutments and putting those bridges well above where a flood stage would be. It's pretty high, if you've noticed. So there are a lot of things we can do and we should do, and I want to make sure that we do what we can here in Congress to keep us moving in that direction. Thank you for the call.
Our next caller, Congressman, is Lisa from New Kingston. Lisa, are you there?
I am indeed.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Congressman Fasso, for holding these phone meetings. They're very useful, and for taking my call. My concern is about the Russian attacks on our election process. It's now pretty much a given. There are so many agencies that have said this is a real thing. And I'm deeply troubled by the lack of urgency in government regarding this. It's seen as though the Russians are attempting to erode citizen faith in the institutions that are crucial to our democracy. And I'm just, what are you seeing up there on Capitol Hill? Is it that people genuinely don't care, or that they do care and they're not doing anything, or that they feel it works to their advantage? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, what is behind the lack of action? It's very disturbing.
Well, I agree with you. It is it's an outrage what the Russians did in the 16 election. And while I don't think, and there's no evidence, in fact, I think most of the people that have looked at this have said there's no evidence that any of their actions actually changed any election results. However, what their real motivation is, and what Putin, who's still a KGB guy at heart, in my view, what their real motivation is to destroy Americans' faith in our own system, to have us attacking and going after each other tooth and nail, to diminish our faith in the electoral system, to diminish our faith in democracy. So I think it's really, really important that we address this. We did enact tougher sanctions on the Russians. Frankly, I'm very disappointed the Trump administration has suspended those sanctions, as the president has the power to do. I think that was ill-advised. And I think that, you know, the Russians are not our friends. I remember back in the 2012 election when Mitt Romney, in the debate with President Obama, said that, and he was derided by this, by saying this, he said the Russians were the most clear and present danger, national security threat to the United States. And President Obama, I think, unwisely accused Romney of wanting to go back to the Cold War, or words to that effect. So I think that the key here is for all Americans, whether you're on the left or right, whether you're in the middle, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican or something else, all Americans to recognize that the Russians are not our friends. They want to diminish our confidence in our political system and our electoral system, and that we have to be vigilant about guarding against this and not allow these controversies to cause us to get into this fratricidal war here in the United States among ourselves, but make us resolute in our determination not to, I don't know what happened there, but make us resolute in our determination that we are not going to abide this kind of Russian interference in our political process and our electoral process. Last thing I'll say is that the Russians have been doing this for decades, for more than a generation, and it's very well known that in the 1980s, the Russians were behind and helped pay for a lot of the nuclear freeze movement, particularly in Europe, because that was in their political and military interest to do so. And when the Berlin Wall fell and the KGB files were opened, that degree of Russian manipulation became apparent. The Russians are also, by the way, have attempted to do this not only in our election, but the French election and in other elections in Western Europe and in the former Eastern Europe. So I think the Russian influence is not benign. It is malign. And I think we've got to recognize Putin is not our friend. And while we have to have relations with them and we have to make sure we're talking to them, don't have for a moment think that they are anything but an adversary of ours on a military, a diplomatic, and economic sphere. Thank you for that call. I totally agree with you that with your opinion about what the Russians attempted to do 2 years ago.
Congressman, we have time for one more quick one. Just to remind everyone on the phone, if you'd like to leave a message at the end of this call, please do, and we will work on getting back to you and answering your questions. For our last call, we have Leo from Kinderhook. Leo, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Leo.
Congressman, I want to give you high marks from just listening to the variety of calls on the issues that you've received. It's apparent that you're attempting to do your homework and just on an extemporaneous basis to speak in the manner you have was pretty impressive. I think what I want to say to you, not so much ask you a question, is to convey to you, as earlier callers did, the extreme frustration that I think exists on the part of the electorate, you know, your constituents. I hear it in the American Legion. I hear it in the VFW, the Elks Club, various church groups that I work with and interact with. And I think what you need to do in going back to Washington, and I know you've been trying to do this, is to convey to your leadership that why all of you are in Washington is to do the people's business, not individual business, not party X or party Y, their business. And it seems to me that you have lost your ability to come up with realistic compromises on issues. For example, if you put side by side the issue of gun control or something needed, and then next to it you put immigration reform, it seems to me that there will be very fertile ground for both Republicans and Democrats to make some strides in those areas and come up with something that would be responsive. And with respect to one of the earlier Second Amendment champions, while I certainly don't want to see any damage done to the Second Amendment, I know if I were living in New York City and I got in a car and I drove to Baltimore, I could probably come home at the end of the evening with five or six pistols that I could hawk on the streets of New York City, and those things would get into the wrong hands. So please remember to do the people's business. Please remember that compromise is essential, and please take this message to Washington. If you wish to respond to anything I've said, please do so. Thanks for listening.
Leo, thank you for that. And I firmly believe that compromise is not a dirty word. It is a necessary ingredient. It's how our system was founded. It was on compromises in the Constitution, compromises that have brought people together, that have made our country stronger. And I certainly will stand up for my principles, but I also recognize that I'm sent here to get things done. I don't like the inaction in Washington on a whole host of things. It is very frustrating to me to be here sometimes to listen to the ridiculous explanations I hear from people as to why we can't do something. Oh, the Senate won't do it. Oh, I'll get a primary if I do that, if I take that position. You know, you have a 2-year term. This term, this job is not the be-all and end-all. Our job is to come here during the time we're here and to try to do the best we can for our country, to preserve this Constitution, to preserve our American way of life, and to advance the cause of liberty and freedom and the rule of law in our country. That's what I stand for. That's what I'll continue to do. Thank you, everyone that's come on the call. As you know, you can leave a message for us, and we'll try to get back to you on this. We've had over 200,000 communications from constituents in the last 14 months, so it's really quite something. So we try to get back to everyone. I hope we can live up to your expectations. And if you want to make sure you get our weekly emails to find out what we're doing or not doing from your point of view, go to faso.house.gov. Thank you so much. God bless everyone. Be safe in the storm, and God bless America.